I'm Terry Saderin, and I'm going to make this really informal today. I'll do a sort of presentation, but if you've got questions, please feel free to interrupt me, and hopefully Karen.
Or additions.
Or additions, yeah.
Or contradictions.
The truth. There's a phrase in music and literature called aria da capo, and it kind of means revisiting the same theme over and over again with a little variation. And I sort of feel like that when I walk through the village. It's like everything's the same, but everything's changed. And I've noticed that with work that I did, electrical work, I guess, primarily. I mean, there's still baseboard heaters, you know, where we put in the baseboard heaters in all the buildings, but all the conduit on the outside of the building that we put in to feed the baseboard heaters is no longer there. So it's, there are all those things, transformers, transformer poles, power poles in different positions, you know, but they're still feeding power to the building, and that sort of thing. Every generation has its own stories, happy, meaningful, terrifying, or risky. And a couple of my stories are unique. I just noticed today that I do have the distinction of being here on the coldest day and the warm, hottest day in the last 50 years. Yeah, but not the hottest day. So that's notable. I was here for 8 summers and 4 winters in the 60s. Today I'm giving 2 presentations, one today and one Monday. And today I'm going to talk about the first 4 summers and 2 winters, with particular emphasis on the work I did around the village. Apart from the theater that I did here the first 2 summers. It's going to be mainly nuts and bolts discussion. The session that I'm giving on Monday will be more about the life of the village and culture in those years during the 60s, you know, those turbulent, wonderful black liberation, women's liberation, Vietnam, drug culture, 60s.
Woodstock.
Woodstock, yeah. Yeah, we're pretty close to Woodstock here, I think. My first summer at Holden was 1963, and that was the first year of programming under Carol Hinderly as the director. I came here from Minnesota with a group of 12 theater people, mainly students from Augsburg College, and our job was to do plays for the guests. And we had a repertory of 4 plays, and there were, you know, Ibsen and Chekhov and T.S. Eliot, and, you know, they were pretty big productions. And we loaded all of our lighting equipment and costumes and props and limited scenery on the boat in Chelan for the trip up late. Now they wouldn't allow you to do that, I'm sure, but it was way too much stuff. And then everything, including us, was transferred onto the big 2-ton flatbed truck for the trip up the village. We rode in the back of the truck, dusty, and it was kind of cloudy and misty that day. And when we got into the village, the clouds parted. Beautiful. The village was far from comfortable in 1963 and 64. There wasn't any heat in any of the buildings, and except the dining hall. Hot water in the showers was iffy, and most of the time it was ice cold.
What time of year did you go?
June.
Ooh, yeah.
We were here for 2 weeks, and then there was a group that came, and it was called Camp Farthest Out. And it was its own group, and they didn't want theater people here. So we had to leave. And I think the chairman of that group was, who was the president?
Ruth Carter, is that?
Yeah.
Well, Ruth Carter was a part of
Ruth Stapleton.
It was a very charismatic, non-denominational group that kept the village alive for the month of June.
Right. Financially.
Financially, yeah.
Right. but anyway, we did our plays in the VC. It was ice cold in there, no heat. Benches that are kind of along the wall there in D.C. didn't have any padding back then. They were just hard as can be. And people wrapped in blankets to sit there and watch our wonderful productions. But it's, you know, the plays stimulate a lot of interest in the community, a lot of discussion. And it was pretty noble of Carol Hinderly to have a theater group. That was their sole function.
Were you the only program besides Bible study?
No. I don't think so. This is the Holden Highlights, Volume 1, Number.
1963?
Yeah. So this gives some of the, I haven't read it for a while, but it gives some of the programming that was happening. I've never referred to the village as she, but here it says, Holden Village owes more to her mayor, Gil Berg, than any man. Just noticed that today. We brought our own big dimming system for the lights and so on. When I bring up the lights in there for the stage lights, the place was on diesel generators then, and it was way too much of a load for the diesel generators. Uh-oh. So all the lights in the village would just go down and then slowly back up. Times have changed. The diesel generators were on 16 hours a day, and then they were shut down, and it was totally quiet and totally dark in the village. Everyone had candles in their rooms, all the stuff you can't do now. There were no linens or towels or pillows furnished. Everyone brought their own sleeping bag. There were some wool blankets that I think were left over from the mining days. They sort of looked like military wool blankets. And after the first commercial dryer was installed here, I think it was 1968, about then, somebody washed all of these wool blankets in hot water and put them in the dryer, so they shrunk down to about that size, so they had to sew two of them together to make them warm. There were no washing machines in the village, other than two wringer washers that were in the basement of what was then the hospital, it's now Agape. And you brought your laundry up there, all your clothes, you just dumped them on the floor, and there were two staff people that would wash your laundry, you know, through the wringers and rinse them in the tubs, and then hang everything on the lines up behind the hospital. And at the end of the day, you'd go up there and you'd kind of find your own, you know, underwear or whatever, and take it with you. But they had, you know, they had sweatshirts here then that were, you know, red and blue, deep red. And they didn't really pay much attention to sorting out colors. So sometimes your undies, your white undies came out to be powder blue or pink. It's a lot of fun. The second summer I was here, I wasn't content just doing theater. I like working with my hands and doing other stuff. So I asked if there was something I could do, and my first job was to take all the radiators out of this building, which was just like all the other dorm buildings at that time, in preparation for the change that was going to be made here. This room, this meeting room, and the library down the hall, and sleeping rooms upstairs. I think this building is probably morphed more than all the other buildings combined over the years. It just kind of, this room stays pretty much the same. There are, you know, changes made, but additions on, and for several winters the kitchen was here and we all ate here. So it's changed a lot over the years. The next summer I came back on the staff, and I was assigned to the electrician, and we spent almost the entire summer putting in little 1500 watt fan driven heaters in all of the chalets, and kind of upgrading the whole electrical distribution system around the village, putting in new power poles and transformers and all of that sort of thing, in preparation for what was going to be coming, which was the hydroelectric plant. There weren't many tools here or machinery to work with. I actually saw the mechanic once grind valves for an engine, taking a piece of gum, sticking it on a stick, and going like this on the valves. Valve grinding machine. And that was done up in the huge vehicle garage, which burned down. When did that burn down, Carl?
77. It was while I was here.
We're at 76.
It was a nice big building.
Yeah, it was a scary fire. That was a scary fire.
I bet. Yeah. It would have been even scarier if it had burned down when I was here, because we found old dynamite up in the second level.
Well, there was a gasoline storage right next to the building. There was gasoline stored right next to the building, so we didn't know that
before. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
And all the oxygen tanks that were inside the settlement.
So they blew like rockets.
Yeah. Wow.
Fortunately, there was 10 inches of snow everywhere.
Yeah. Unfortunately, didn't have a place to do the work then in the snow. We spent a lot of time scrounging for stuff like electrical insulators and going through the old mill site and finding stuff, going up the high line, came up the valley, and I climbed the poles there and take insulators and that sort of thing. Place didn't have any money at all. I thought I'd, for those of you that don't know, have any of you been to the hydro plant? it's a little building, about a quarter the size of this room and about half as high down the road and across the footbridge. And through this little building, 27,719 pounds of water per minute flow, spinning a 2,400-pound magnet at 600 revolutions per minute. And that provides us with lights for your hot food, for your heat, jacuzzi, all of that sort of thing. This is the hydro plant at Holden. To give you a brief history of the hydro plant, I'll just relate that. I wrote an article about 8 years ago for the Holden paper on the history of the hydro, and what I'm going to tell you, they sort of excerpted from that article. When Holden was donated to LBI and subsequently the Lutheran Church by Howlestown Mining Company, one of the initial concerns among many of the daunting challenges was how to acquire electricity. During the mining days from 1937 to 1957, the mining company purchased power from the Chelan Public Utility District, and there was a 212,000-volt power line that ran up the north shore of Lake Chelan, across the Donkey Mountain, across Railroad Creek Valley, and up the valley to a transformer substation up on the mine level. In retrospect, it's hard to believe that anything other than hydroelectric power was considered, but in 1960, generally recognized discussed options were to reactivate the power line from Chelan and pay a maintenance fee on the poles and lines and be charged for the electricity. Generate electricity with diesel power generators or install a hydroelectric plant. Over the next 2 years, a very dedicated volunteer committee comprised of 11 people researched many possibilities. They pursued leads for used and new power plants throughout the western United States.
And in the meantime, you have diesel.
Yes, right. Right. Well, they started researching this even before the diesels. Hydropower emerged as the most feasible option. Several sources for generating electricity were studied, including Railroad Creek, Termite Creek, Big Creek, 10 Mile Creek, and Copper Creek. The conclusion was to utilize Copper Creek for a high-pressure, low-volume system with a relatively adequate amount of water throughout the entire year. Since freezing temperatures reduce the amount of water during the winter, the amount of water from the mountains during the winter, the reduction of power generating capability from December through April has continued to be a challenge even to today. The committee considered many sizes of hydro plants. A small plant given consideration involved salvaging the 125 horsepower motor from the mine's emergency water pump, still in the concrete structure right down by the footbridge, and connecting it to a turbine to generate about 35 kilowatts. Well, 35 kilowatts go very far today with what the village is. They also considered a large 350 kilowatt unit, which they had come across. While the planning was happening on hydropower, two 50 kilowatt diesel generators were used for power 16 hours a day during the summer. Those generators are still here today and are used during the winter to supplement the power during high, low times over the holidays. A lot of people are here. An ad was placed in the Equipment Advertiser, which in early, this is before the days of the internet, obviously, which in early 1963 led to two used hydroelectric generators. They were owned by the Lewiston Orchards Irrigation District in Idaho. They had not been in service since about 1945, and for a couple years had been exposed to vermin and the elements. Someone wrote to one of the committee members indicating he knew of these generators. His statement was, "In all probability, rats have worked on the windings, but if you're real cautious, like, I'll bet you can get the whole mess for a song." So with the authorization of Gil Berg, the honorary mayor of Holden, and a retired businessman from Seattle, Washington, they were purchased by a wheat farmer in eastern Washington for Holden. A 300 kilowatt General Electric generator with a patent date of December 2nd, 1902, a Pelton Dobley turbine, exciter generator, and governor cost $900. A 200 kilowatt Westinghouse generator with a patent date of August 29th, 1916, an Allen Cunningham turbine, a governor, an exciter generator cost $300. Along with the major components, many controls and spare parts such as oil switches, meters, rheostats, coils, bearings, valves, and transformers were included. So for about $1,200, they bought that power plant. Once the permit for water rights was assured, the work started immediately on the powerhouse on deeded land owned by Holden across Railroad Creek. From the village itself is on Forest Service land, but the power plant is on Holden property. Most of the initial costs were covered through the generous gift of $4,000 from a church in Ohio. The engineering and supervising of everyone was done by the brilliant, self-taught Henry Schwecke for the wage of $20 a day. Over 40,000 pounds of the generating equipment was shipped up Lake Chelan in a barge. And with the assistance of loggers and their equipment who were working in Railroad Creek Valley at the time, the hydro machinery was hauled up to Holden. The powerhouse footings were poured and the building was framed in with the generators and turbines enclosed by October 24, 1963, which is a remarkably fast period of time to get that they got this done, considering Holden time. Usually it takes a long time to get anything done. Before the snow on November 1st halted any further work until the next summer, 1964. Utilizing the water from the mine's domestic water diversion dam, the Holden Village Power Plant was first placed into service on August 6, 1964. Under the guidance of the Holden business manager, Werner Jansen, and Henry Schwecke, the work on the new diversion dam, settling box, and penstock, or pipeline, was accomplished at a site 200 feet higher on Copper Creek than the mine dam. Sand and gravel was dug from a small gravel pit on the side of the road between Lucerne and Holden. It was sifted and sorted through screens on the mine level by hand, and before being hauled up in a homemade trailer to a mixing landing about 50 feet above the dam level. The concrete was mixed in a large old mixer, shoveling the sand, gravel, and cement into the mixer by hand, and the concrete was shot down to the dam footings in flumes that we made. The settling, the dam and footings for the settling box were completed by the time the first snow was falling in October of 1965. The summer of 1966 focused on building the settling box and flume. I don't have any visuals, but this shows you the hydro plant or the machinery when it was first mounted on the slab for the powerhouse. And then these are pictures that I took a few years ago of the various components in the hydro plant and of the former dam and settling box. There's now a different system up there. After 40 years, the settling box, which was wood, pretty much gave way. The summer of 1966 focused on building the settling box and flume from the diversion dam and laying 3,000 feet of 14-inch steel pipe from the settling box to the hydro plant. The pipe was hauled up from Lake Chelan on a logging truck and to the mine level, and from there, piece by piece, up the hill, up the mountain, to the dam on a war surplus four-wheel drive bomb loader. And it's still in use down by Lodge 6. It's painted green now. It was kind of a yellow before. On August 11th, 1966, the water supply to the hydro was switched to the new dam. And I was with Henry Schwecke when that water switch happened. We were up on the hills, fairly close to the dam, but a ways down, and there was a dog leg in the penstock, in the pipeline. It had to make a curve to head down. And he was most concerned, we stood there because he was most concerned that the sudden pressure of the water into that pipeline would, that dog leg would just give way, that joint there would give way. But he just, that's what he was most worried about. But
you should explain who Henry was. He lived across the lake.
Well, yeah, Henry Schweck, he was this self-taught, brilliant engineer that was in charge of this whole project. And his wife was a medical doctor, and she was head of the Chelan Douglas County Health Department. And they had a place over across the lake by Moore Point.
He had put it in the little hydro.
Yeah, he had a little hydro plant over there. And part of the deal, he made a little more than $20 a day in that every once in a while he needed some labor. And so Holden would send, a few of the staff over there to help him do some heavy work or shoveling.
How big is the staff then?
How big was the staff?
Yeah, in 66.
Well, I guess there were a lot more like Maverick type workers. There weren't as many, there wasn't as big an administration, or there were very few paid positions then.
Probably two or three.
Well, that was about it.
Were they hippies or were they?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
All kinds of people.
And Schwecke wasn't a hippie.
No, he was.
College kids.
I don't know how many there would have been.
20 to 25 workers plus more skilled people doing skilled projects.
Well, there weren't the positions that there are now, the utilities manager and all of that, the positions there are now. Because they weren't really necessary at that time, and nobody knew what was really needed, so we just sort of winged it in many aspects, I guess.
And was the Lutheran Church kind of advertising Holden Village, or how people find out about it, by word of mouth, or?
Yeah, it was mainly through the churches.
Was it?
Yeah. Carol Henderley and the development director would go around to the churches and talk.
And when was the World's Fair in the 60s?
62
was advertised widely that people should come to Holden on their way to or from the World's Fair.
Oh, really?
I don't know how many did, but I think some youth groups and, you know.
Plus people went home, people who were here and worked here would go to their home churches and do slideshows and presentations to the men's club and the ladies' group and to the church down the street, and so it got spread that way.
Mm-hmm. And through the colleges also, the targeted colleges per se. Anyway, the water was switched to the new dam. The operating pressure from 160 psi to 282 psi, which is a significant advantage in spinning that.
So up until that time, the hydro plant was operating, but with the other domestic water, or a different water source.
Yes. Yeah. From the lower dam. Beginning in the summer of 1965 and continuing through the winter and summer of 1966, the electrical distribution and infrastructure at Holden was expanded and upgraded. New service panels and electrical heating was installed in most of the buildings, and new power poles and transformers replaced those from the mining days. It's rather amazing that throughout nearly 50 years of operation, most of those taking care of the hydro plant have had no formal training in power generation or electricity. Many improvements have been made in controlling the loads electronically. There are, on both generators, governors which deflect the water to or away from the buckets on the turbine, the spinning wheel. And that's a mechanical process, but it's a little coarse. And now there's an electronic system that dumps load or turns hot water heaters on, depending on the cycles or voltage that's coming through the system, right?
Yes, based on frequency.
Yeah.
So as the generator slows down, it turns the load off.
Right.
If it speeds up, it turns it
so
off.
So the governors really aren't even doing much anymore, I guess.
Only in the summertime. Once we have more load than generation, then the load controller does all the work. Yeah.
Right, right. And there are priority zones, right? Like the kitchen is a priority. And so, you know, you may get a cold shower because the kitchen has the priority. And, you know, basically the plant looks today like it looked in 1965. Okay, well that's pretty much the article that I wrote 2 years ago. So back to my little history. At the end of the summer of 1964, I decided to stay the winter. There were going to be five others besides me. Wes Preeb, Holden hero number one, was going to be the chaplain and the cook.
You're kidding.
No. I rolled my eyes when I heard that. Couldn't change one of mine. Harvey Matheson, the mechanic, Howard Berkman, a worker bee like me, Walt Olson, the electrician, and Reuben Thompson, who had been here as a caretaker for 3 years already. We're all going to be living in Chalet 1. Well, in September, Harvey Matheson decided to return to his folks' ranch in Montana. In October, Howard Berkman was drafted. In December, Reuben Thompson left. Around Christmas, an enormous avalanche tore down Martin Ridge between the village and the diesel plant, wiping out the power line from the hydro, slamming up against chalets 10 and 11, pushing out the rear windows in those chalets and filling the bedrooms with 4 feet of snow. It also hit the lodges 1 and 2, pushing the snow up to the second floor. There was a garage on the road, little road up to the hospital, that was wiped away with an El Camino in it. Just west of the village, across from the garbage dock, there was the firehouse, and it had the village pickup truck in there, and that was just demolished. The pickup truck was pancaked, the roof was just pushed down to the seats, and yet we salvaged that and pushed the roof back up. Didn't have any windows now, but it was serviceable for many years after that. I had gone to Minnesota for a couple of weeks for Christmas, and I got back on the 28th of December, and it was utter devastation here. There was no power, tons of work to try and salvage things. I shoveled out the chalets, repairing the windows. It took about a week to dig and pull the high power lines out of the compacted snow, which were pushed across Railroad Creek up under the first tailing. We then ran a temporary 2200 volt power line.
So who was here, you and Wes and Werner? Or wasn't Werner here?
No, Werner wasn't here.
You and Wes?
No. When it actually happened?
Well, when you came back.
When I came back, it was Walt and Wes and me.
Wow.
So we got the power lines out of the compacted snow. We put a cross arm on a tree just outside the village. And we ran the 2200 volt lines to there and then to a power pole in the village. And those high power lines, the primary lines, were just above head height when they're walking in the snow. So you didn't want to skip across the snow or jump. Granted, we didn't have much power then anyway, because the system was still on the old dam. So we had just enough power for a few lights, and we could either have the hot water heater on in Chalet 1 or the electric cook stove. So we had to be sure that we shut off one or the other when we were doing the other thing, or needed. And the heat was furnished by the fireplace in Chalet 1 and the wood cook stove in the kitchen. Great, big, nice wood cook stove. It was pretty much chilly all in all the time. But, you know, I really didn't bother me too much. But it bothered Wes. So Wes left. So it was down to Walt Olson, the electrician, and me. In preparation for the increased hydro power that we are going to be experiencing, Walt and I ran conduits along the outside of the buildings for the electric heat, which I referred to before. And it was actually pretty handy to do that during the winter, because when the snow slid off the roofs of the buildings, we were kind of at the second floor level, so we didn't really need ladders. There was, at that time, there was no mode of transportation other than snowshoe. There was an old Bombardier, small Bombardier snowmobile, like I think the first small snowmobile ever made, one-person snowmobile. But the engine on that had burned out halfway down to Lucerne early in the winter. And so it was a huge problem just taking the engine out of that, getting it out to be rebuilt, and then getting it back in. And that took months. Toboggan.
But you snowshoed to the lake.
That happened when I was in Minnesota too. Reuben burned it out. But when it came back, I had to haul it back up the mountain on the toboggan. Which was really awful, because I was snowshoeing and pulling this toboggan, and the toboggan would go into my snowshoe tracks and tip, and the engine would fall into the snow. And back and forth. And I finally got it up to the carcass of the snowmobile and lifted it on there and bolted it in place and got the snow off of everything and kind of started up. But when you send something out to be rebuilt like that, they don't send it back with everything. So none of the control cables were there, none of the clamps were there, nothing was there. So I had to kind of do whatever I could with my hands and teeth and toes, and I nursed it down to Lucerne and kind of worked on it a little bit there, where there were Oscar Getty had some more tools and whatever. So I eventually got it back up to the village, but it was quite a process. It was almost, it was very hard dealing with that machine, because it had one track about that wide, and the track would just get compacted with snow and the heavy wet snow up here, and it would just stop. So you'd have to turn it on its side and chisel out the snow, and you know, then you go another 50 feet and do it again and again. I just finally, it was easier just to snowshoe. So, anyway, that's snowmobile. Well,
you were going to talk about Oscar Getty.
Yeah, well, I am. Yeah, I'm getting with it. Walt left in March, so I was here. Left alone, and it was the best time of my life. I finished off the inside of the hydro plant in that time. It was all just the old wood and the old studs that salvaged from the mill or whatever to build the plant. And so I put plywood all around the inside, painted it all gloss white, ceiling, walls, everything, put up a rack so you could get up to the disconnects. And it was, you know, it was a lot of fun for me to do that. I had to be kind of careful, because I needed some power tools. So, you know, when I was working up above the generator, I had to be careful I didn't fall into it. My ladder didn't fall into it. But I was very cautious, because I was here at home. And then I did a lot of reading. The library was very small at that time. It was the little room right across from the snack bar at the end of the Village Center building. But I read a lot. And I only had the need for about 4 hours of sleep. And I think it's mainly because there was no pressure from having anyone around. I didn't have to deal with anyone. There's no psychological pressure. And it was kind of invigorating. Well, the food was terrible by this time. It was terrible. Not that it was ever great. Cases of eggs had been shipped up in the fall, and they were put on the enclosed back porch of Chalet 1. And they were, in a word, stale. The meat was institutional-sized roasts, I think left over from the summer. They were in a small freezer up in the kitchen that were freezer-burned beyond belief. And having partially thawed when there was no electricity here, and then refrozen, they were pretty awful. I would take one of these roasts. They were, you know, like that big, and I'd bring it down to the carpenter shop, and I'd cut off a chunk in the bandsaw. I think the sawdust made it taste kind of okay. We had slab bacon, I had slab bacon, and it was all moldy, so I'd take vinegar and I'd wash off the mold before I cooked it. There were big number 10 cans of sauces and vegetables from the summer, so you know, that was my, those were my greens or whatever. Everything was stored in the hotel. The only halfway palatable things to eat were apples that some orchardist in Manson had shipped up in the fall, and there were just big boxes of those lining the lower corridor in the hotel. But they were pretty good. They lasted the winter. They were, you know, a little shriveled, but they were okay. The Blue Jays and the camp robbers got to know me. They learned where my bedroom was in Chalet 1 and learned about the time that I would get up. And so they would sit on the window ledge and tap on the windowsill or the window until they'd see me get out of bed. And then they'd fly down to the back door and wait for me to throw up stale bread. I would snowshoe down to get the mail about once a week. Even catalogs are nice to read.
But that was 20 miles round trip. Huh? That was 20 miles round trip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes I'd leave at 4 in the morning and meet the boat at 11:30. And snowshoe back, getting back here about 8 at night. I'd have to shut off the hydro in that time because I never knew what might happen to that hydro. You know, if I didn't make it back or whatever. But I keep the water flowing just so that the line wouldn't freeze up. One time, I was about halfway back up the village. It was about 3 in the afternoon, and it was kind of dark. I mean, you know, it gets dark early here during the winter. A huge cougar ran across the road, right in front of me, like 25 feet in front of me. And it was big. It had paw prints about 8 inches in diameter. It was about 10 feet from nose to tip of tail. And I, you know, I was just startled. I couldn't believe it. It was kind of beautiful in a way. And I wasn't afraid, but I was more startled. It just ran right across the snow in front of me. But I did, you know, the whole way, rest of the way up to the village, I was sort of, looking in all the trees. But I think he probably saw my big snowshoe tracks and thought, well, that got way too big for me to.
Quick question. You said you left the, you turned the hydro off, but left the water running, so was the generator spinning? It just wasn't energized?
Yeah.
Okay.
I turned the water down just, you know,
yeah,
just so it
just
kept flowing
just
a little bit. I don't even know if it was enough to turn the generator,
okay.
But.
All right.
One day, a helicopter flew over, and I knew they were probably going up to Cloudy Pass to do a snow survey, which they would do periodically. And so I put some sheets of plywood out in the playground on the snow, and then I ran up to the hotel and they had these huge boxes of Jell-O. And I got a big box of cherry Jell-O. And I wrote in the snow, coffee. I ran out of Jell-O. I think I got one E out, but I didn't get it. But they saw it and they came down and landed and came in for coffee.
Oh! Well, like you were inviting them for coffee.
Yeah. Not like I needed it. It's just, they got it. At other times, I would snowshoe down, and I'd stay down at Lucerne. Oscar Getty, who owned 29 acres down there on Lake Chelan, was this old pioneer in the area. And I was really privileged to get to know him. But he would let me stay in one of his old cabins down there. He had built several old pretty much shacks, just one room cabins, for the miners. Miners would live down there. And they had a couple of creaky old beds in them, you know, one little wood-burning heater. But he would let me stay there overnight. And his wife's name was Mona. And one time I was there and they were arguing about whether it was his 80th or 81st birthday. So he was born in about 1885, figure. He was a real pioneer in this area, pretty famous character. Mona always left when the winter got really bad. She just wouldn't live down there. She had been a teacher in the Lucerne school down there, so she was, you know, pretty educated person. But she was pretty coarse too. She smoked cigarettes, and she had this gravelly voice, and she was a Goldwater Republican. So anyway, I'd stay in one of these cabins, and you know, it'd be ice cold, so then you would heat it up in a little wood stove in there, and you know, it was just fine. And then he would cook dinner and breakfast for me, and he was an excellent cook. He was really a good cook, and he would very often make elk stew, and it was really wonderful. Bacon and eggs in the morning. It was a lot better food than I had. So I was happy to be there. One time he was serving me dinner, and he put a bowl of jalapeno peppers out there, pickled peppers. And I had never seen them before. I didn't know what jalapeno peppers were. I'm a Norwegian from Minnesota. And so I took one thinking, well, it's just a pickle, you know. So I ate the whole thing. He was watching me like a hawk. He eyes were glued on me, and he could see me sort of choking. And just, the tears were rolling down his face. He was laughing so hard internally. But I think he liked me. I was just a kid in this place that was never going to succeed up here. He didn't have electricity, and he had a servo kerosene refrigerator that sat on the porch. And I was fascinated by that. I'd never seen a refrigerator that burned, that kept cold with kerosene. So that was an interesting concept to me. One time he said to me, "Terry, if you had any ambition, you'd snowshoe up to Heart Lake every day and get 3 or 4 ptarmigans for breakfast." And Oscar had a corral there, and every once in a while he seemed to have like 4 horses shipped up lake on the barge, and he put them in his corral. And one time he asked me if I would ride them up to the ballpark up here to graze, and I said, "Oscar, why do you have horses?" He said, "Terry, some people have dogs as pets. I have horses." So I rode his horses up here for him.
The story I used to hear about Oscar was that during the mining days, he took his horses and packed them up to Lyman Lake, or took people on pack trips, and carried and had 2 hens along with him, so they had fresh eggs.
Oh yeah, I believe it.
And I don't know, bacon, and I don't know, maybe they a cow. Oh yeah, he brought a cow up there, and they milked a cow or something.
He was something else. He had this little airtight heater. He'd say, "He used to be able to get these for 2 bits, you know, 2 bits. And this little airtight wood heater. He'd have a coffee pot on there that just kept boiling all day long. It was like tar, you know.
Every day he'd add another cup of coffee.
Yeah, right, yeah. It was pretty hilarious. And he was pretty filthy in a way. I mean, he kind of a little rotund guy. He had this, you know, dirty old pants on with suspenders and kind of a plaid shirt on, just dirty as can be. I don't think he ever bathed. And sit in his rocking chair, smoking his pipe in the corner, listening to Paul Harvey. He had his battery radio. He'd listen to Paul Harvey every day, puffing on his pipe. That was his clue, his insight into the world. Every Friday, Dinsmore Bigger, who was the caretaker of Moore Point Resort across the lake, Gordon Stewart, who lived at Thompkey Lake, and Oscar would have what they called the Friday Club. And they would get together and drink and commiserate and philosophize. That was their life for years. And I never participated. I was young, and I just didn't want to be there with these old guys drinking in this place. So I didn't participate. Gordon had lived at Thompkey for almost 50 years at that time, and I don't know how long he maybe lived there. When did he die?
Well, he was still alive in 80, I think, or maybe not. He died in the 70-something.
So he was there for maybe 60 years, yeah. 65 years. And he had a cleft lip and palate. He rolled his own cigarettes. He always wore the same type of hat, kind of this broad, looked like an old ranger type hat, broad brimmed with a pointy top, and And I, after I left here, I went to Valparaiso University and I took a course in geomorphology, which is sort of the study of the Earth's features and so on, and opened it up to Alpine glaciation, and there's the Lyman Glacier, and there's Gordon Stewart standing on the Lyman Glacier.
He had a trap line,
and he, before he went up on his trap line, he always took his valuables, whatever they were, money or...
His stock certificates.
Stock certificates,
yeah,
exactly.
Stock.
He was pretty wealthy.
Pretty wealthy.
And he'd put them in a sack or something, and he'd stick them up in a tree somewhere tight, just in case the place burned down or something before he got back. And one time he, in, when was it, 68 or, he gave us a beaver that he had trapped. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we fixed it here. The kitchen was here. And a beaver. It was delicious. It was really delicious. I mean, everyone liked it. But we're already gone, check out.
He had several, he had I think 10 or 12 hired girls at the end of his life that came and spent, cooked for him and took care of him. And when he died, each of those girls, I'm friends with at least three of them, they received $10,000 from Gordon. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he once asked me if I wanted to come up there and help him out and take care of him, and I thought, no thanks. The last person in the world I'd want to live with.
You were notorious for hating women.
He was?
I thought he was notorious. He didn't.
Well, I think he was sort of antisocial.
Shy, maybe. I mean, he had these girls working for it. But
he had a cabin up there, a couple cabins. And executives would fly in there for stag parties and go fishing, on the lake. They come in by seaplane, and they give them tips on the stock market. And so he played the stock market, and he made a lot of money. And then they always leave him their booze that they had left over. So he had, the best scotch, and here's gin. It was amazing. Quite a character. Well, as I, walk around the village now, there are all kinds of antennas and satellite dishes and everything. Well, in 1965, there was an old crank phone on the porch of Chalet 1 with a line down the road to Lucerne, to Oscar's place.
Really?
And then there was a line up to Donkey, to Gordon. So, we talk to each other every once in a while. But the line from here to Lucerne was always breaking because the snow would fall on it. So I'd spend hours, just tromping down the road, trying to find where it was broken and haul it back out and try and repair it. It was a lot of work. May 9th, 1965, it was 83 degrees and there was 60 inches of snow. So I decided to get a good dose of vitamin D, so I put on my boots and my snowshoes and I took a hike. Just my boots and my snowshoes. I was pretty buff back then.
So did you get a little burned?
Yeah.
Slightly burned. Oh my God. So what, did you just die of sun?
Yeah. It was pretty liberating. But that was the 60s, so it hit me even up here. I was the only one in the valley, and no one could get up here because the road wasn't plowed. So, if the Forest Service blew over, I just tied under a tree, I guess. not very PC practice at that time was to put out a salt block in back of Chalet 1 for the deer in the spring. As I recall, the salt, like, you know, like what you give the cattle, was furnished by the Forest Service and was kept in the basement of Chalet 1 until the spring, and just stick it out on the stump behind Chalet 1. Well, there would be, you know, 50 or 60 deer trying to get at this thing. And I discovered that if I walked very slowly, without moving my arms at all, I could walk right into the middle of them. Which probably wasn't the safest thing to do, because if I'm sure that if I'd made any sort of an aggressive move or raised my arms, they probably would have torn me apart with their hooves.
Were you getting vitamin D at this time also?
No, I'm a little more protected then. With the first staff arriving about May 20th, I had a lot to do. I had to hook up the water lines, and all of which had been drained for the winter, in the hotel and a couple of the other of the critical buildings. I started the boiler in the hotel and made sure that the large diesel-fired range worked.
Did you get any kind of a stipend during this winter?
No. It was all volunteer. The range was incredible. It must have been 12 feet long, I think. And that was the only cook surface they had. It was all diesel-fired. And there weren't any electric ranges up there. In the previous fall, a couple of buses and the truck were parked down at Lucerne, down at the lake, and the Ford tractor with a backhoe and scoop shovel was parked at the top of the switchbacks. The vehicle batteries were wintered in the basement of Chalet 5. Chalet 5, where they were kept charged along with the large wet cell batteries for the dial phone system between the chalets and the dining hall and other key buildings. There was actually a dial phone system here, and there was this interchange in the basement of Chalet 5 that just index and it would click up, it was all magnetic. And you know, when you dial a number, go like that, and you could call the chalets. It was pretty neat. It eventually stopped working and no one could repair it, I guess. After schlepping the batteries down to the vehicles and getting them going, I plowed the road bit by bit. Much of it was completely cleared by then, but the shaded areas or avalanche area had several feet and needed to be broken up and scooped out of the way. With about 20 people coming in, I needed to have lunch ready. Let's see, stale eggs, shriveled apples, moldy bacon. I opted to bake bread and open institutional cans of minestrone soup. It all worked out fine. They were very impressed.
You didn't think about the 70 deer outside your door?
That comes Monday. Well, I was happy to see people. You know, every year I said, I loved the fall because I was so glad to see people go. And then I loved the spring because I was so happy to see people come in. Kind of an odd thing. Anyway, I was happy to see them. They were happy to see me. And they all commented on my haircut, which I had done by myself, scissors and a comb, looking into two mirrors. All I have to say. Until Monday.